Last week I started a talk on how to get rid of bad habits. I sort of went over the foundations for it, and if you weren't here, don't worry about it. I'll go over the basic important stuff that I covered. Today we're going to really the heart of how to get rid of bad habits. So, why are bad habits so ingrained, so difficult to... Why do they seem so hardwired? They start out, people have all sorts of names for bad habits. In 12-step groups, they call them the god-awful character defects, which is an awful term. I prefer coping strategies. They start out in childhood. When we're young, we are very vulnerable. We know that we're very vulnerable, and we're very dependent upon our parents to protect and give us emotional mirroring, security, a sense that we'll be loved and fed and protected. And very often, we develop behavioral tendencies and thoughts when we feel frightened or unprotected. We use what methods are available when we're very young. Often when we're very young, the methods available to us are pretty unskillful. When we're caught doing something and we feel frightened about the repercussions, often we, for example, lie or create an implausible story to get out of the situation. If we feel that we're being ignored or not paid attention to, we might exaggerate or throw a fit. If we are frightened of a confrontation or something that might go wrong with an interpersonal interaction, we might avoid the entire interaction altogether. If we don't have the things we want, we might steal or take them without permission. So, these behaviors, when they work, the part of the limbic system called the amygdala and the hypothalamus release a lot of wonderful chemicals that tell another part of the brain, you guessed it, the dorsal striatum. It's my new favorite part. Last year I was all about the insula. This year it's the dorsal striatum, which is part of the reward circuitry of the brain. The dorsal striatum is where habits are consolidated, where things that we do that we see work are hardwired or hard encoded. Eventually they become so economically wired and easily triggered that they can feel automatic. The good news is that even though the dorsal striatum, as part of the reward system of the brain, generally when the brain feels frightened or that there's an opportunity, it goes directly to its ingrained habits and the striatum and says, what should I do? I'm terrified, or I could get laid right now. What should I do or say or think? And the striatum immediately provides provides its favorite behavior. If it, for instance, if you feel, here's a good example. Some people, when they go through a breakup and they're upset and they spend weeks and weeks and weeks obsessing, trying to figure out what went wrong, trying to figure out, oh, if only I did this or done that, try to find the perfect little thought to make all the pain go away. That's an ingrained habit, because at some point in our childhood we experienced an upsetting rejection, and we experienced having a thought that made all the pain go away. We thought a mean thing about the person who rejected us, and all the pain went away. So from that point on, we immediately have the habit of, when we go through a rejection, when somebody dumps us, the best thing to do is think of, what's the one thing I could think to make all these tough feelings go away. It's an ingrained habit. Well, when we get fired from a job, think mean things, or how much they're going to miss us, or how wrong a decision it was, or whatever. Or what could I have done differently? This ingrained habit of, oh, if only I could come up with that one right thought, that one right conclusion, that one way to file it away, I wouldn't have to feel all this vulnerability and this loss and all that. So it's an ingrained reward system. The brain feels threatened or nervous, thrown about, discombobulated, and it looks for something that's worked in the past. And of course, the bulk of these things that have worked from the past are from our childhood. They work very well when we're children, but a lot of these coping strategies, they don't work very well when we're adults. For example, avoiding confrontation works well when you're a kid. When you see bullies, you might want to avoid them. But when you're an adult, and there really aren't that many bullies out there, we still find ourselves avoiding any unpleasant interaction. That's a problem. Or when we find ourselves exaggerating every event that's happened to us in our lives because we feel that our normal experiences aren't that interesting to other people. So these are habits that work when we're children, but they don't work as adults. But by the time we're adults, they can be awfully hardwired, right? The good news is that the frontal lobe can override the striatum. There's just enough axons and dopamine in the frontal lobe that it can say, no, I'm not going to do that this time. But it takes an awful lot of things to go right for it to override a habit and stop it in its tracks. Buddha called habits anusayas, A-N-U-S-A-Y-A, anusayas. He made whole lists of them. He was fascinated with bad habits. A lot of our bad habits come from, are the result of, that we're unaware in any given moment of how much stress we are under. We don't feel how much stress we've accumulated. And by that point, when the mind feels all this unconscious stress in the body, it's much more likely to trigger the striatum and act out of a habit than if the body is relaxed and there's less stress taking its toll on the mind. Even though you might not be aware consciously of how tense you are, of how much contraction there is in the body, actually there's a lot of good science. Antonio Damasio has done a lot of great books on it, showing that unconsciously we're always aware of what's going on in the body. We're just not consciously aware. Sometimes when you finally get away from a stressful situation in your life, you let go of something that's been plaguing you. You finally quit a job that's been stressing you out, or quitting some responsibility that's been taking its toll, and you start noticing how your body relaxes. But all that time while you were doing it, you didn't notice just how much physical stress. Well, that physical stress is always taking a toll. It's always there, and your mind is always aware of it. It's always having to, the part of the brain called the cingulate, which focuses your attention, is always having to say, okay, I know you're stressed out, but I'm really not going to pay attention to that because there's so many more fascinating things going on out there that I really don't want to notice the fact that right now my shoulders are really tight and my stomach's really tight and I'm really feeling nauseous and I'm really feeling sweaty and I'm uncomfortable. So the foundation for overcoming bad habits is first making sure that we're physically comfortable. Last week, by the way, for those of you that weren't here, I talked about the four foundations of entering the change, a period of change in our life. And I'll just go over them really quickly. They're having skillful friends, because if you're always surrounded by people who are acting unskillfully, you're probably not going to change. So having people that are meditating, exercising, being honest, not drinking obsessively or excessively. It's a good idea. If you want to be capable of change, surrounding yourself with, not everybody has to be a spiritual practitioner, but having a couple of them in your life would be helpful. Hearing some form of spiritual message, because so many of the messages we hear from the world are panic. You ever turn on the news? The message is panic, right? You know, everything's going wrong. Everything's bad. The future's terrible. So if you want to have even a decent shot of developing a spiritual practice, it's a good idea to get some spiritual thoughts into your life. It doesn't have to be from me, please. There are tons of great teachers in many, many different traditions. So, but having or listening to the web once in a while, where there's tons of great Buddhist monks and Hindus and Quakers, I'm sure there's some Quaker podcasts out there. I love Quakers. It's just good, because if you don't, the message you're going to hear all the time is worry about your financial security, worry about your job security, worry about what's going on in the world. And there's some truth to that, but you need to hear something to counterbalance it. The third is being able to have sustained attention, because if you don't see what's triggering your bad habits, you won't know how to go about avoiding those triggers. And we'll talk about that in a second. And the fourth is putting into practice what you learn from seeing what triggers your bad habits. And we'll talk about that too. So the first thing is just to keep some awareness as you go through life on what's going on in your body, keeping your body as relaxed as you can. The more relaxed your body is, and there's a lot of good science behind this, the less likely you will fall into obsessive thoughts and fall into obsessive behaviors, because your cingulate, the part of your brain that determines what actions you're going to take, will be less distracted. You'll have more resources to it. You'll have more ability to override the habits. Now, the second is also keeping in mind the other states that are going on in your mood and in your mind. For example, those of you who have any experience in 12-step groups, they talk about knowing if you're hungry, if you're angry, if you're lonely, and if you're tired. The reason is that a lot of the things that trigger us are, in fact, not external. We have a tendency, because we're so externally focused, to believe that all of our habits or our suffering and our stress are caused by things that are going on externally. Oh, I hate my boss, that's what makes me lose my temper. Or my roommate leaves a towel on the floor, that's why I get frustrated. Or I only get agitated when I talk to my mother on the phone. Actually, an enormous amount of the triggers for our habits come from things that are going on well before those external events. If, for example, the Buddha said to keep track of what mood we're in. If we're in a mood where we feel that we don't have enough, that we feel that we are in a deprived state, a state of feeling less than, having less than, a craving state, we're more likely to fall into an immediate habit of trying to act as if we're coming from a lesser than, a very vulnerable place. We'll often then find ourselves doing things that we wouldn't normally do if we were coming from a place of abundance. For example, if we feel financially vulnerable, we might, in our workplace, find ourselves saying or doing things that later on would cause a sense of uncomfortable reflection. The more we're aware of what's going on, the more aware we are of what's going on before we engage in any interaction, what general mood we're in, whether we've had enough to eat, whether we've had enough sleep, whether we're tired or we're groggy. The Buddha talks about the hindrances, knowing whether we're in a craving state, we're in an angry state, we're in a tired and groggy state, we're worried and anxious, or we're just self-centered and consumed with self. If we're aware of those five hindrances and if they're going on, we'll be less likely to act out because we have a sense of self-awareness. We know not to trust the first thought or behavior or idea that comes into our mind. Because if you know you're angry, if you say to yourself, I'm angry right now, at least there's that little remove, that 1 second pause where you might have that enough insight to pause and breathe or reflect before you act out. Now, it doesn't work all the time, but it's something to bear in mind. Along with relaxing the body, it's worthwhile to be aware of what mood you're in, what's the underlying state of the mind, and address it. If you haven't had enough sleep, well, you might want to get some rest, obviously. If you haven't eaten, it's a good idea to eat. If you haven't, of course, this is why the Buddha talked so much about how much we should sleep and eat to his monks. He didn't say it to lay practitioners. He sort of thought that we'd have to find our own solution with that. But he talked a lot to monks about that because he was concerned that people act unskillfully when they don't have enough sleep, they don't have enough to eat, they're improperly taken care of, and also if they're just not aware of what kind of mood they're in. Having skillful thoughts in your mind and rewarding yourself for them is a very important practice. Again, bad habits are part of a reward system in the brain. The brain feels that it will be rewarded for falling into whatever bad habit you've fallen into. We all have our own bad habits, so I'm not going to list specific ones. In my own case, I'll just say I used to have a really bad habit with exaggerating. I thought it would be fun when you're telling a story to exaggerate the hardships of life. It gets attention. But after a while, the long-term drawbacks of exaggeration are not good. People stop believing anything you say. Or they start assuming that no matter what it is you're telling them, it's an exaggeration. That's the thing about all bad habits. They all work in the short term. Lying works in the short term and gets you out of a bad situation. Stealing gets you more money or more things. You know, worrying obsessively makes you feel like you've got things taken care of. Trying to predict the future makes you feel like you're prepared. Worrying about what people think about you makes you think that you've got everybody sussed out. So all these things give you a momentary sense of control. In the long term, though, they all suck, right? They all take their toll. So that's the thing about our bad coping strategies and bad habits, is that we have to stay with them long enough to see that they don't work, so that when we catch them, we can play the tape all the way through. For instance, if we've been through a breakup and we've been thinking a lot about the person that we've broken up with or who's broken up with us, it might be very tempting to see, oh, if only I could think of the one thing I did wrong, or maybe I should never date blondes again or brunettes or whatever. Short people, tall people. I'll never date a tall person again. And then you think, and then you get all stressed out because you're back again in the obsession, and it didn't work out. So the next time you catch yourself beginning to think about, oh, what's the perfect way to think about this relationship that has died, you'll play the tape all the way through and you'll say, oh my God, when I try to think of this, it makes me feel like I've got some power in the short term, but in the long term, I waste a half an hour getting stressed out, and I wind up feeling all nervous and all sad, and it doesn't help me do anything else. It doesn't help me process the feelings. It doesn't get me any further in any understanding. All that is playing the tape through. So it's very, very helpful to keep the body relaxed, the mind relaxed, notice what underlying mood you are in, and rewarding yourself for thinking thoughts that don't cause stress, doing actions that don't. The Buddha said, reflect on the skillful things you do. Reward yourself for them. A lot of people have a lot of trouble with this. I've known a lot of people who, for example, when they try to give up smoking, and I always say, well, you know, one thing that's been shown clinically to work is to reward yourself by buying yourself something with all the money you would have spent on cigarettes. It actually has been shown to help people quit. And I go, no, I should know not to smoke. I shouldn't reward myself. And they self-sabotage themselves just out of this feeling that they don't deserve to reward themselves, that we should all be perfect. I should know not to do this. I should know not to eat a pint of ice cream at night. I should know not to overspend on my credit card. I should know, blah, blah, blah. I should know. I should be perfect. Well, that's not the way it works. If you want to replace an ingrained habit, which is part of the neural reward system in your brain, guess what? You got to replace it with another reward that's skillful. Just trying to get rid of a reward circuitry with nothing is not going to work. Your brain is going to feel like, oh my God, you're depriving me of a tool here. Now, I know that maybe lying and avoiding doesn't work, but you're just asking me to give it up without anything in return. Your brain is not going to like that. Frankly, I don't like the sound of that either. I like to reward myself when I do things skillfully. That's how I've become the spiritual giant that I am. If only you could hear my brain half the time. But seriously, anytime I have in my life been able to triumph, however minutely, over any unskillful bad habit, it's always because I've rewarded myself, I've felt good about, I've treated myself to things that feel good and don't have a long-term bad result. When I've gone through periods of my life where I've been obsessed about something, I don't just try to get rid of the obsession. I often reward myself by watching my favorite stupid TV show, reading my favorite stupid magazine, reading my favorite stupid graphic novel, or doing things that I like, buying a CD, whatever. Whatever it is that makes me feel good that doesn't have the long-term drawbacks. I try to feel really good when I do something skillful. Another technique that really works when dealing with bad habits is what I call the every other hour techniques. I've done this with some practitioners. It tends to work really well. If you find that you've got an obsession that's particularly strong, worrying about finances, worrying about your health, worrying about what somebody thinks about you, or how you compare to other people, allow yourself 1 hour to think as much as you possibly want about whatever it is that's driving you nuts. And then the following hour, you're not allowed to think about that no matter what. You can think about anything else but that one thing that you've been obsessing. If a thought comes up during the second hour, tell yourself, well, in hour number three, the odd hours, I can go back to obsessing. When people practice that enough, they start seeing that the hours where they obsess and worry are so unpleasant, and they start experiencing that the hours where they don't allow themselves to worry and obsess become so much more relaxing, that just the experience of seeing that not falling into this thought or this behavior, eventually they become to experience that there are other, more rewarding ways to act and think than the one that's been causing them the stress. Now, there's also the what I'm going to call the cat urinating problem, which is, if any of you have cats, I'm a cat person. When you have cats, they have this unfortunate tendency to, they're wonderful creatures. They tend to be very self-reliant, but they also will piss sometimes anywhere they want. And the problem with it is that the one way to train a cat that's really effective, that's not, except, you know, that's not cruel, is to get a spray gun of water, and you spray them.
The problem is, if you wait until even 2 minutes after a cat is pissed in the wrong place and you spray them, they won't have a fucking clue over why they're being punished. You may say, you know goddamn well why I'm spraying you with, why I'm coming, and believe me, I've soaked my cat. But, but they will not have a fucking clue, because 2 minutes to them is a fucking lifetime. They don't have, they do not have the attention span. They are already onto something else. They're trying to catch a pigeon or worry about a lint or, you know, catch a rubber band. They don't have a fucking clue that you are spraying them because they have urinated on your table. They will not know. It's the same thing with bad habits. If you wait until 10 minutes after you've procrastinated, you know, or avoided talking to somebody, crossed the street rather than dealing with seeing somebody, if you wait until, you know, a half an hour or whatever, and then you say, oh, bad me, bad, 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 bad. It actually, you're consciously, you might know what you're talking about, but the part of the brain that matters, the striatum and the amygdala, will have no clue. Will have no clue why you're beating up on yourself. The key is to catch yourself in the act. Just like you want to catch the cat when he's urinating or she's urinating and spray them right then so that they associate urinating that area with bad, you want to stay mindful and present enough that you can catch yourself when you are in the behavior that you want to change. That's the only time when the Buddha said it's skillful to use something he called samvega, spelled S-A-M-V-E-G-A, samvega, and it means developing a sense of shame. Not at yourself, not self-shame, shame at the action. The Buddha said all actions are universal, so when you develop a sense of shame at an action, it's nothing self. It's not personal. It's simply you're developing a sense of shame at the action, which is transpersonal. We all lie at times in our lives. In our times of our lives, we've all avoided things. We've all procrastinated. We've all obsessed. We've all, you know, binge-ate or whatever it is we do. We've all acted obsessively. It's nothing personal. So if you, in the act of when you are about to, for example, greatly exaggerate about something that happens, if we catch ourselves and we say right then, you know, when we're talking to the other person, you know, I was just about to really exaggerate, and I don't need to do that. That generally builds up just enough shame at the action itself that you'll associate it with unpleasantness, and you'll start to less hardwired into the brain. Again, do not develop personal shame or shame about yourself as a human being. It's just the action, not you. It's just an action that we all do. So if you find yourself acting unskillfully when you're doing it in the act, that's when, especially a harmful action, something that's going to hurt you or hurt somebody else, that's when to develop that sense of, ew, I can't believe I was going to do that again. That sometimes is very skillful in the long term. So those are tonight's techniques that I'm going to talk about. I'm sort of doing a whole series on changing bad habits and obsessions, so I'm going to give another talk on it next week. So to go over tonight's tools, which are all from the Buddha's series of reflections, skillful reflections, keep the body relaxed. Keep aware of what's going on in the mind, what kind of mood you're in, and whether you've, you know, been taking care of yourself. Reward yourself for behaviors and actions that are not unskillful. Try to catch yourself in the act. And when you do, develop a sense of shame, not at yourself, but the action that was going to cause suffering. And also remember the other techniques of, if you can, surrounding yourself with people who are exhibiting the behaviors that you want to develop, because the brain is a imitation machine and it learns from observing other people. So it's very helpful to surround yourself, if you're giving up something, with other people who have managed to overcome the same bad habits that you're trying to work on. So that's tonight's talk. I hope you got something out of it, and now's your time to share anything about anything that comes to mind, any questions or any experiences. So thanks for listening. Hi.
Hi, Josh.
Sure. Right.
And it threatens my sense of security as well. You know, it's like, that's my money too. You know, so.
Well, I mean, the first thing that's, it's a great, great thing to bring up. And the brain is has a great technique of not learning, which is called rationalization. We can rationalize some of the most, almost unbelievable behavior because A, we feel that the things that we do, if we don't do them, first we feel extremely vulnerable if we admit we're wrong. Like somehow, because we don't understand that we're just talking about actions, not core. In Buddhism, there's no core personality. But because we tend to think in terms of that, if we experience any criticism of an action, we think it's a criticism of our core identity. Oh, if I'm ever found out to be stealing or lying, that means I don't deserve to live, because that means I'm a stealer or a liar. Really, what is happening is, at various points in our lives, we all are capable of acting unskillfully, and then we grow up and we see that these behaviors don't work. One of the ways, though, that we keep behaviors ingrained for longer than they should be is we rationalize them. We tell lumps, well, everybody else does it, and, you know, why should I give up, or I deserve this money, or blah, 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 and we tell ourselves these stories, largely because we're so scared to admit just that these behaviors are unskillful. And at the same time, we don't have to turn into this huge personal thing, like, I'm a terrible person. It's just a matter of seeing this action of not sharing the tips equally is unskillful. So she's not yet at the place where she understands that you're just talking about an action. You're not saying her core identity is this horrible, horrible. She probably does some nice things in her life as well. It's just in this one environment, she's probably got a lot of financial security. She probably doesn't think she's going to be taken care of, so she thinks she deserves to take a shortcut. And all she sees is the short-term results. She doesn't see the long-term results of the action. Now, for our part, once you've done the skillful thing, is saying, hey, you know, this action of, you know, that you're undertaking, it's not appropriate. It's really not the way, you know, we do things here. And it's an unskillful action. You know, it's just not a skillful way to go about your job. It's not fair to the other people you work with. After that, then our role is to reflect on karma, which is that, A, she's got to live in the results of her actions, and there's nothing that you need to do any further than to call attention to it. You know, obviously, if it grows even more to the extent where she's literally depriving you of a substantial amount of your income, there'll be other actions that you probably have to take. But in the short term, the most important thing after acting appropriately is then reflecting on karma, which is that she's got to live in that head, the head of somebody who feels the only way she can survive in life is by taking from her coworkers or acting like this. She's going to have to live in the results of those actions. You don't. So reflecting on that, almost always when I encounter people who are acting unskillfully around me, makes me feel like, okay, there's less I have to do. That's the point of karma, which is knowing that there's only so much we can do. And the moment we start feeling, well, I have to do more, I have to think about this more, I have to engage more, that's when we're less trusting in the fact that everybody lives in the results of their actions. And they do. I've not met
anybody who gets away with acting like that. They all wind up having to live, if she lives like that for the future, she's going to wind up in a mind that doesn't trust anyone, that can't believe she's taken care of, that won't believe that she's going to, she can trust, and, you know, she's, imagine living in that mind. It's a horrible place to live in. There's nothing you need to do when you really see the implications of what she's going to have to live with. So that's what I reflect on, frankly, that, you know, there's almost always, I need to do less and worry about it less than I always need to think, you know. You're taken care of. You have a good life. You have a spiritual practice. You don't feel you need to steal or act underhandedly to get what you need. So you know you're going to be living in a much better mind, a much better place than she will be if she lives and acts this way. Thank you. All the way in the back.
To say if somebody's been dishonest to me in the past and then I'm dishonest to somebody, I'm so much more aware of it, and I'm so much more aware of the suffering that it causes, and I feel a lot more conscious of it. And I'm wondering if that's sort of an operation of karma as well, sort of this ability, sort of like as a tool for insight.
Mm.
Sort of like, oh wow, you know, 10 years ago I behaved that way with that person and that was really harsh. Now that somebody's being really harsh to me, and I'm really seeing how much suffering that causes, you know, that kind of thing. Like seeing it, being able to see it from all sides.
Mm.
And I was just wondering, sort of, your thoughts on that, or any sort of statements in any of the sutras that kind of reflect on that.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, the Buddha often talked about how the mind becomes subtler and more refined the more it gives up unskillful behaviors. It becomes more aware over time of the little, of what we call going from the gross suffering or stress that's induced by behaviors. We'll become even more and more aware of the subtle. A funny story, many, many, many years ago when I got sober, I went to a meeting, an AA meeting, and there was somebody there who was speaking, and they talked about how they had drunk by accident caffeinated tea, which had thrown them entirely out of whack. Now, at this point, I was very, very new in my sobriety, and hearing somebody complain about drinking caffeinated tea sounded like the most wussy thing you could pot, like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm like, you know, my life is a shambles, blah, 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 you know. You're talking about caffeinated tea. And nowadays, if I drink accidentally a caffeinated tea when I don't want to, you know, it can throw me entirely. Because over time, we become more, as we become less and less distracting ourselves with externals, less and less abusing ourselves physically, less and less engaged in addictions that have gross effects on the body and the mind, more aware of the long-term repercussions of our actions, we become more and more refined as to what the minute, small little, you know, disturbances, behaviors can have. Ajahn Jeff gives a lot of talks about how, you know, at the beginning of a spiritual practice, we can only see the big, huge things, like it's bad to, you know, it's bad to lie, it's, you know, good to meditate. But over time, you know, we become more and more finely tuned. And we can see, oh, you know, when I procrastinate putting off doing these little things, or when I, don't do my spiritual work, we can see the minute shifts in our moods and in the way we feel. And that's the overall, I think, the beauty of spiritual practice, is that there's always more work to be done. It's always more refined. There's always less at stake in terms of overall suffering, but it's still, there's always more of a journey ahead where we can fine-tune and let go of suffering, even though it might not be the huge suffering at the beginning of the spiritual practice. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Sometimes it's even a subtle thing, like somebody with just slight disregard for like one moment, somebody maybe I care for very much. Then I suddenly realize, maybe I see it on their face or in their body language, and I'm like, oh, I remember what it feels like to have a dear friend diss me, even if it's just for a moment. So it's just constant awareness. But I don't want to feel like I'm too hypersensitive. But I think it's somewhere in there, there's going to be like a healthy balance.
Right. Thank you. Hi, did you?
Hi. You talked about the Buddha saying that we should check our moods.
Yeah.
I know this may be a silly question. I was almost not going to raise my hand again, but mine changed so often sometimes. I could feel confident at 6 o'clock and at 6:03 feel insecure. I could feel hopeful and like everything's good and I'm taken care of. And 8 minutes later feel like nothing's good, I'm not taking care of it all. And this happens more often than I care for it to happen.
Mm.
So how do you kind of wrestle with that?
First of all, that's, even though our moods can, we can be in points in our life where our moods change quite rapidly, it's important to stay abreast of what's going on, because the last thing you'd want to do is, you know, with a child or with, you know, a friend or with, lash out simply because you weren't aware that imperceptibly you shifted from a sense of peace to a sense of fear financially, or a sense of being tired, you know, or from a sense of, you know, where your blood sugar level is completely going awry. Even though it might happen quickly, we wouldn't want to fall into, you know, because we'll feel bad about ourselves and our, you know, we'll certainly have to live in the results if we wind up being unaware. The simplest way to deal with the fundamental quick shifts that we can go through is have a place in the body where you can keep track of, that you know will get tense whenever there's a, generally, the same part of the body will get tense, whether it's an issue of, you know, agitation or hunger or worry. In my case, it's my shoulders or my stomach. My stomach will always get tight and my shoulders will always start tensing. I don't have to be aware of every last thought or every emotional mood. I can just keep an awareness on how tight my belly is. And I can begin to know when I'm going through any kind of underlying stress. Just that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have two markers that you stay aware of, if you notice that they're relaxed, then you're safer to follow your habits and your initial impulses than if you notice that there's a lot of physical underlying tension. Once that's happening, you know that it's a better idea, no matter what's going on, to take a pause, breathe, and before you react, ask yourself, is this something that play the tape all the way through. Is yelling and getting angry going to get me the long-term results? Is it something that always works? Is it something that always makes me feel good about myself? Is it something that I feel comfortable with? Once you do that, then maybe you'll catch yourself. So start by having that underlying physical awareness of one or two parts of your body.
That's actually really helpful. Thanks.
Sure. Did you remember?
I've just been noticing, or I guess more aware, that any time I've got a change going on, or just and this or a decision, whether it be moving or new job or new position, that I'm extremely anxious, like anxiety, not anxious, anxiety, and I can feel it in my body, that my heart starts beating really quick, and you know, like I'm about to run away,
right?
And I just do it every time. So I guess that's a bad habit that we were talking about, and so I'd like to change that.
To use a great example of that is the a well-known example of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is very similar to Buddhism. It's just Buddhism in a nicer name or different name. When somebody has a fear of heights, you don't ask them to, you don't bring them up to the top of a building, push them up against the edge and say, look down, you know, or B, why are you scared, you know, because it's an amygdala reaction. It's not going to understand reasoning. Your amygdala, which is a preconscious part of your brain, which develops the fear mechanism, which creates what's known as vedana or gut fright, you know, wanting to run away, it's not going to understand logic. Like, oh, running away, avoiding the situation is not going to, you can say that all you want, it's not going to teach the amygdala anything. The only thing that teaches the fear part of the brain not to be so frightened or not to trigger the panic button is to slowly, over time, gradually, with smaller, the smallest increments and the safest conditions, train it to go through versions of the thing you find unpleasant to show it it will be okay. So, for example, if you have somebody who's frightened of heights, you bring them up to the top of the building on the elevator, but you don't make them get out of the elevator first. You just say, okay, we're staying in the elevator, we're not going to get out. And they're, of course, they're breathing rapidly, but you're not forcing them to do anything else. The next day, you have them stay in the elevator and just put 1 foot out. Right? 1 foot's in the elevator. Then they go back down. The next day, you bring them and they have both feet outside, but they still have a hand in the elevator so that they know they can. You get the idea. It's very, very slow and gradual, showing the brain that you will be okay. Now, with examples like moving, quitting a job,
right,
going through difficult conversations, you practice with a smaller version. If it's moving, you might want to consider what's a small variation of that, like, you know, can I move some of my stuff into a storage, or can I, you know, let go of some stuff? Can I, you know, what's a variation on putting myself through a change? You know, maybe I'll go to a different restaurant or walk into a different neighborhood, just to put myself through a variation of what it's like to go through change and walk through it and build up gradually till you're mimicking closer and closer behaviors that are the same kind of behaviors that you're frightened of, or that, you know, involve change. But you got to do it gradually, slowly, and you can't jump into the big things. Like if people who are terrified of commitments, you know, rather than immediately trying to find the next person and get married to them immediately, that's not going to work. You know, sometimes people will first, you know, get a dog or plants or a, you know, an animal. Sometimes they might try dating once a week. You know, I mean, you don't jump in head first. You find a way to gradually build up that feeling that you're going to be okay, that you're going to be taken care of. Another thing to do is, of course, the more you have your spiritual practice, the less you're triggering the fear mechanism in the brain, and the quicker you can turn it off, the more you'll be capable of finding a secure place and in your body, breathing, relaxing, and then, you know, choosing different options, being aware. That helps, of course, a great deal. But really training yourself slowly, practicing, building up to whatever it is. So see if you can find a variation on this, whatever it is that you have a fear of or concern about, and see if you can get out of your comfort zone and still see that you'll be okay and build up to it.
Okay.
I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah. I also, I find like so when I sit and meditate,
yeah,
then the whole time is just the rumination about the decision.
Right.
I do this, I do that, and it's like, and every once in a while, you know, go back to the breath, and then more of that. Go back to it. It's like mostly that, though. It's mostly not being with the breath at all. So there's no peace in the meditation. So I don't know if that's a...
Just first see that. Just see, experience that, that it's, just see what, every time you think about it, what happens to your body. Observe that it's causing stress, you know, and begin to associate all that. And then, you know, give yourself a sense of real reward if you can even count to 10 breaths. Like, feel really good about that. Really reward yourself with a feeling of, you know, that's great. I counted to 10 without thinking about that thought, you know, about that fear. And also, the most important thing is just don't take it personally. We all, in various points in our life, go through, you know, times where we really, really can't settle down in the meditation. There's nothing personal about it. The more we add a sense of, oh, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with my mind? What's wrong with me as a spiritual practitioner? Why can't I? Everybody else, I'm sure, is like the Buddha, but I'm the one here who's... No, everybody else. I bet you that at least 33% of the room is like frantically obsessed about something when they're meditating. 33% is mildly obsessing, and the other 33% has a momentary peace that will quickly go away, you know? So don't take any of it personally. It's just the nature of being a human being. So listen, those of you who have any more questions, please come up and say hello to me. I'm just going to, because it is 7:30, thank you all so much for coming. I hope to see you next week when we talk more about getting rid of bad habits and other things like how to make decisions without losing our minds and stuff like that. That's the upcoming talks I have going. So thank you for coming. And those of you who haven't met or want to ask me any more questions, please come up and say hello. Thanks.